Thank you, Eric. Hello, everybody. As Eric says, I'm Head of Digital Research at the Bodleian, and I'm going to talk today about a very small project which has got quite interesting implications for the library in delivering digital collections. But before I get to that project, I thought I'd talk just a little bit of context about the Bodleian and the digital library. Some of you may have been to the Bodleian libraries this week. You might know we were founded in 1602. We have lots of physical libraries. 30 libraries make up the Bodleian Library Group, including the Western Library, which is our special collections library. And some of you might have been there, seen our exhibitions and so on and so forth. We're one of six legal deposit libraries in the UK, and we are the libraries of the University of Oxford, so we have a remit to meet the needs of all of our divisions across all subject areas. And effectively, we operate as custodians of treasures, basically, our cultural heritage treasures that we have. If you go down to the Western Library, you'll see our treasures gallery with some of our beautiful things in it. So we're responsible for looking after these amazing things. Some of the special collections that we have are manuscripts, rare books, maps, music, the kinds of things that you would expect a library to hold, but also things like we have a painting collection, mainly oil paintings, but some other bits and pieces, and we have quite a large collection of ephemera. So because we're a copyright library, we collect all sorts of things that you might not expect, and there's a very interesting collection called the John Johnson Collection, and you can find that online also. So we have a responsibility to look after special collections across subject areas. And we have a commitment within that to making our collections open and accessible and usable by lots of people. So we don't want to hold them back and not allow anyone to see them. We want people to use them and access them, and that includes the general public as well as academics like yourselves. We also have a commitment to making our collections available digitally, and that's part of the work that I do. I work for the digital library part of the Bodleian. One of the main ways into our visual collections is through digital.bodleian, which you may have come across, and this is our relatively new platform for our digitised image collections. And the idea behind Digital Bodleian was that we wanted to bring our collections that we're digitising into one place. People could access them easily. We could go in and have a single searchable, browsable location so that anything that you're interested in that we have available as a digitised image collection, we can allow you access to it via Digital Bodleian. And that launched last July, I think it was. And this is an entry point for academic and non-academic users. So it's a way of browsing all of our collections, whatever might interest you. And it enables us to collaborate with our other institutions via metadata standards and shared image standards and that sort of thing. And this was part of our strategic commitment to making our collections accessible. So we're very used to thinking about, as a library, about delivering our online collections as a sort of large-scale activity, something that's fairly central to our strategic plan and something that our academic users need and want. And we tend to do large-scale digitization projects as well as smaller individual research projects. One of the more recent ones is the Polonsky Foundation Digitization Project, which is a collaboration with the Vatican Library to digitize our Greek and Hebrew manuscript collections and some of our 15th century books. And that was a large donation of money from the Polonsky Foundation, which enables us to do that portion of our collections and to make them available. And those will be available via Digital Bodleian. Okay, I'll try. I do have a mic.
Is this mic doing anything?
I don't know. I do have
it. A little bit there. So
okay.
Point that toward you.
I'll try that. So the photography for Digital Bodleian and for our Polonsky Foundation is done by our in-house imaging services. We have a team of professional photographers who live in the basement, basically, of the Western Library. So we keep them hidden so that they get on with what they need to do. But we have a team of professionals who do that for us. Another contextualizing project for this individual one that I'm going to talk about today is the Digital Manuscripts Toolkit project, which some of you may have come across. this is another way that we like to work with our manuscript collections. So we look to build tools to enable people to use them. DMT is a project to build a IIIF compliant toolkit. This is International Image Interoperability Framework. And it's about bringing together shared image standards and shared metadata standards to enable people to use manuscripts in interesting ways, to deploy them in ways that they want to work with them, to curate them, to compare them with other collections. And we were funded by the Mellon Foundation to do this. And the idea is really that it allows you to pull together, to curate your own collection effectively, and work with them directly on your laptop or on your PC. And this facilitates projects like this one, the Digital Mushaf, which was one of the projects that we worked on for DMT. The Digital Mushaf is focused on early Quranic manuscripts. And the interesting part of this slide is the line across the top, because the manuscript itself was disbound in, I think it was the 16th century. And it was held by different institutions. So we have MS Marsh 178, which is in our collection. And the rest of the manuscript is in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin, in Wolfenbüttel in Germany, and in the Bibliothèque Nationale. So this manuscript was distributed. And what the IIIF toolkit technology allows you to do is to pull in those images from different institutions and basically reconstruct the manuscript. And when you're looking at something like this, if you go to the dev site, you're seamlessly paging through the manuscript as if it were a whole manuscript. You've reconstructed it. And if you weren't aware, you wouldn't necessarily know that this is actually something that's divided. And what's exciting about it, or exciting if you're a tech nerd like me, is that you're pulling the images from the BNF. We don't host those images. The BNF hosts them and we pull them from them. So this is a way of certainly showing impact at the originating institution, but also to taking the load off whichever institution is hosting the images. So you can see, I hope, that when we're working with these sorts of collections, we're thinking fairly large scale, very professional quality images, and how we can deliver the best viewing experience, zooming experience, panning, and so on for our users. And as part of that, what we try to do more now, we weren't always very good at this, and I think we're getting a bit better at it, is that user needs are actually very important. We need to take account of those for them, and the main reason is sustainability. If we want to build a tool that people want to use and will continue to use, and therefore we can continue to support, we need to know what people actually want. So there's no point in us sitting up in our offices in the Bodley and thinking, they probably want to do this. What we need to know is what you all want to do with tools, and then we can take that back and translate it into a set of functional requirements for something like a digital manuscripts toolkit. So as part of the toolkit project, I went out and spoke to lots of users and did some requirements gathering. And in the main, I talked to manuscript scholars about what they do with digital manuscripts, what they would like to do, and so on and so forth. And one of the people that I went to talk to was Daniel Wakelin, who is Jeremy Griffiths Professor of Medieval English Paleography at the University of Oxford. And I can thoroughly recommend going to talk to Dan if you ever have a chance, because you come out with more ideas than you ever thought you could possibly have from a half-hour conversation. And usually you go off on a massive tangent from what you had intended to talk about. I went to Dan to talk about what he would like to do with digital manuscripts that we produce. And he said, well, yeah, that's quite interesting, but what I'm really interested in is, what about images that people take themselves? What happens to the images that people go in when they're working in archives and they just take a photo of them? And what happens then? This is something that he does increasingly, and that he encourages his students to do, and he uses it in teaching. And he would like to know what we think about that in relation to our digital collections delivery. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So I went back and spoke to Christine Madsen, who was my colleague at the Bodleian Libraries. She's now a consultant with Athenaeum 21. And her research interests are in the impact of digitization on research and scholarship in the humanities specifically. So she, again, was interested in this as another aspect of digitization. We should look at what the impact is. From my perspective, it was more about what is the impact, or the what should we take into account when we're thinking about our collections delivery as a library. So we went to the FEL Fund, which is a pot of funding that's for university only. It's from the OUP John FEL Fund. And we asked for a very small amount of money, only about £7,500, to do a little bit of work in this area. And we're very grateful to them for their support of the project. And what we asked for was some money to do an experiment on Flickr, to host a colloquium, which we did in January, and an edited volume of proceedings that came out of that colloquium. And all of our contributors are, of course, beavering away on their submissions for that now, because we asked them to do it by the end of July. And some structured interviews. So it was about just a small-scale research project. So this is not a huge user survey or a massive amount of data. It's a small indicative look at what the issues are to try and get a sense of what we should be doing. So we made a postcard, rather beautiful postcard, with some images. These are Dan's fingers, and he was a bit worried when we made this that the librarians would throw him out of the library for showing what he does with their manuscripts. But we made a postcard, and we thought we'll invite people to join this Flickr experiment that we want to set up. And on the the text on the reverse of this said, "We invite you to take part in an experiment in DIY digitization. Please upload your digital photographs of the Bodleian Special Collections here." We give the URL. "There are no rules. They're your photographs. We just want to see how people might use this online resource for sharing photos of our collections." So we just wanted to see what would happen. What do people want to do? Didn't really want to guide them in any particular way, because we just want to see what happens when you set up something like this. So we created a Special Collections Flickr site, and we invited people to upload their photographs to it, and it's still there. If you want to join, please do. It'd be wonderful. And we thought, no problem. We'll put our postcards out in the library. We'll stick it all around the reading rooms. Let's just see what happens. I can't imagine that anyone's going to even notice. Well, we caused a bit of a stir in the library. And I think it was the bit on the postcard where we said there are no rules. And they thought, well, actually, there are quite a lot of rules. And let's think about this for a minute. And my curatorial colleagues are wonderful, and they are not at all about keeping their treasures to themselves. But they really, really care about the manuscripts and the books in their care. And they thought, well, hold on a minute. There's going to be chaos, like a chaos in the archives. And what they're worried about, of course, is damaging manuscripts. They're worried about manuscripts on deposit. Some of the manuscripts that we hold at the Bodleian aren't ours, strictly speaking. We hold them for other institutions, like some of the college libraries deposit their manuscripts with us. So we're not really free to just say, yeah, just stick it up on Flickr. So they were worried about that. And of course, the C word, copyright, everyone in a library worries about copyright, especially in the digital library. And people wanted to know about licensing. So they said, there are rules. Let's just remind everybody that there are rules. But what we had meant by there are no rules wasn't that there are no rules about how you handle a manuscript, but there aren't any rules about how you upload them to Flickr. So we realized this, and we added a little caveat on the site saying, there are reading room rules. Don't go in and destroy manuscripts. But in fact, what we meant was, if you've already got images, share them. Not necessarily go and take lots of images for this site, but if you have them in the course of your research, share them. So we were a bit surprised that this caused the stir that it did. And we started the Flickr experiment, and it was interesting because immediately some of the discussions and the early users of the site, the first users of the site, basically had a snapshot of what the issues around this are. The questions that they raised and the issues that they raised were very much what we needed to think about, which was, what permissions do you need to share these kinds of photographs online? What license should they be under? So we had a discussion about which flavour of Creative Commons license that should be. How do you encourage people to sign up to your resource? You need a kind of critical mass around these sorts of resources before they become useful. And how do you actually make it useful to navigate? So the initial discussions were actually the kind of snapshot of what the overall issues were. And these are some of the issues that wonderfully people started to upload. So you can see, I hope, that they're a little bit different in style and approach than the ones that I showed you that were institutional images. And we wanted to look in detail about how these images were being used by researchers, and also to gauge are our curatorial colleagues right to be concerned about this as a development within the reading rooms, and are there more general concerns that we ought to consider around this kind of use of special collections and images of special collections. And I think we very often see images like this in the media. So we have, you know, pictures of people with their cameras firmly between them and whatever it is that they're looking at. And there's a sense now that camera phones are ubiquitous, people, and they're good quality, small, very high quality cameras, you can carry them around, you can use them. And with that ubiquity, there comes a concern that if you're in front of them and you're sort of mediating everything that you look at with your camera, you're not somehow experiencing it in a real way. And for some, this is quite a cause for concern. And in the mainstream media, there's articles like this one, again, accompanied by a photograph of people in front of the Mona Lisa, which is the classic example of everyone just clicking and ticking off on their bucket list or whatever, that in this article they cite something called photo-taking impairment effect, which was new to me, but it means that if we take a photo of something, we're less likely to remember it than if we looked at it with our eyes. Quote, when people rely on technology to remember for them, argued psychologist Linda Henkel of Fairfield University, Connecticut, counting on the camera to record the event and thus not needing to attend to it fully themselves, it can have a negative impact on how well they remember their experiences. So ought we to worry that an increase in use of photography of our special collections materials is actually detrimental to the rigour of their academic research? Are they sort of snap happy, as it were, taking lots of photographs, not really processing it, and does this have a negative effect on the research that they're trying to do? So to look at this in more detail, I did some interviews with people, and originally I'd intended to do face-to-face interviews, and I did a couple. But if any of you have ever done face-to-face interviews, they take a really long time to write up. So I didn't have time for that. So what I did was just send the written questions to people, and they wonderfully wrote amazingly detailed answers back to me, which was fantastic. And this was a very small-scale study, so I'm not implying that this reflects practice across academia or across subject areas, but this is just to get a feel for it within researchers in Oxford. And we got, we issued a tweet about it, and we had a blog post and so on, and I had some people came and suggested some respondents that might want to talk to me. And 21 people gave me very detailed answers. And this was a mix of academics and lecturers, students, and also a few librarians. And they came from a mixture of disciplines. These are manuscript scholars, largely, but they do come from different areas. So some were studying literature or history, art history, but also linguistics and medieval modern languages, oriental studies. And all of them had taken photos of special collections. Only one person got back to me and said, I don't take any photos of special collections, which was helpful because it was sort of showed that some people don't. But overwhelmingly, the people that responded to me said, yes, we do. Only one person said they didn't. And interestingly, that same person got in touch with me about a month later asking for some digital images of a manuscript. Anyway. So of those 21 respondents, 19 of them believe that institutions should make their collections available for reader photography. They were very, very strongly in favour of it. And the other two were not against it. They just thought that it was for the institution's individual decision. You know, if there may be other reasons why an institution might not allow reader photography. It could be a space issue. It could be any number of things. So what it revealed was that it's utterly commonplace. People who work with these sorts of materials are doing this all the time. They do it very, very frequently. So they say, we've got thousands and thousands of images of special collections. I do this every time I go to a library. And the main thing is that it allows me to get through far more material and to examine and analyse it at leisure after the library and archive is closed and I'm back at home. So I'm going to quote from some of the responses that I got to give you a flavour of what they were saying. So this is something that people are doing all the time. Of 21 respondents, these were the institutions that were listed by name as places where they have taken photographs. Some of the respondents said things like at various research institutions in the UK or, you know, various European institutions. But these are the ones that were by name. And what strikes me about this is just 20 people, effectively, and these are all of the institutions where they're working. If you then expand that out to imagine all of the manuscript scholars, this is happening all the time, everywhere. And really, we need to think about what that means, not just for research, but also for library service provision. So this is an important thing that we need to think about. And when we asked them, should there be any restrictions to user photography in the reading rooms, they said yes. For fragile or damaged manuscripts, they find it perfectly reasonable that we would want to hold back anything that might be very easily damaged by allowing access to them in photography. That this should be for personal research only, people should not be taking photos of special collections and then using them for publication or for commercial gain. And that we should be issuing them under a Creative Commons license. And also that guidance ought to be offered by the institution about how to handle manuscripts. So we were comforted by people who said things like, the minimization of stress on the book is more important to me than a perfect photograph. This is what we want to hear as librarians, that people aren't going in and kind of bending the spine of a 15th century manuscript to get a good shot. This is not what people are doing. But there was a sense that we need to, as a library, to give people training in how you handle a manuscript. This is what happens in some academic departments, mostly at postgraduate level, I would imagine, that you do get manuscript handling or special collections handling courses, but that it would be good if the library were able to create courses or create training that allowed people to go from physical artifact all the way through to putting something online and to get a sense of how you handle, what you do, what the issues are around it. And some people pointed out that restrictions on reader photography are hard for people, especially if they don't have much money. So if you can't, if you're really restricted budget-wise and you can't take any photographs, you're forced to stay in a library location for longer, it costs you more money to be there. You know, if you may just have to not go to that library because you can't afford it. And that has implications, obviously, on research. And some people were very kind of, there should be no copyright restrictions, there should be no restrictions on material that is old enough to be out of copyright or that's held by public institutions, the sense that this belongs to all of us and that really we should be making it available. Why do they take the photos? So overwhelmingly, all of them do it for their own research and for a detailed study at home. But 15 out of the 21 respondents also use these photos in teaching, so they're taking it back. They want to illustrate particular examples of manuscripts to their students. So this is something that's embedded both in research and in teaching. And we wanted to know, how does it benefit their research? And overwhelmingly, they all said it was enormously beneficial. It was transformative in many ways. It saves time. It allows flexibility. I really couldn't understand how they would do it without being allowed to take these photographs. It transformed my research on, for example, marginalia, especially in things that are difficult to read. Being able to take them away and get help or puzzle away at them is invaluable. So you can look at something you might not be able to process as you sit there in the library, but you can take it home, you can think about it, you can show your colleagues. It helps do that. And it goes against what we were sort of skirting around earlier, that is this a way of not engaging particularly deeply with collections, and on these responses suggest it's the opposite. It means I am able to engage much more deeply with manuscripts that I might only have had an hour or two to consult physically, and has meant that I have a much wider corpus of images to be familiar with. So they can amass more stuff and they can look at that stuff for longer and in more detail, which doesn't sound less rigorous, which is what we might have worried about. Again, more positives, that it allows slow cross-examination of notes taken at the time, so avoiding weeks of residence working in a library, which is difficult for most people. You don't have to transcribe anything, so you can more accurately. We've all tried to transcribe something in a library and then been horrified later when we realise we've missed a great deal. Having a physical image there to help with that gets rid of that problem. And some people want lots of data. So you want lots and lots of stuff, and you need lots of stuff before you can see a pattern emerging from what you're working with. So this enables this kind of comparative, detailed, data-driven work. So some of these benefits are also true of institutionally delivered content. So if you can look at a manuscript online that we've already digitized, you can do that kind of close comparative work at home. So what are the particular benefits of your own photographs over professional photographs? This was an interesting comment. I thought that a professional photographer has no idea what might be interesting about a page. And I think that's very true, is that if you're only interested in marginalia, or if you're interested in catchwords, or if you're interested in sort of scribbles in the gutter, or even the gutter itself, how something is put together, then you want to focus on that, zoom right in, whereas your institutional photographer is looking at something nice and flat, a beautiful image. Sometimes it's a case where people think, well, no one loves my manuscripts as much as I love my manuscripts, no one else cares about them. It will probably take the Bodleian decades to photograph some of the cheap and tawdry little books that interest me, which I thought was quite sweet. And that's true, because digitization programs tend to favour the beautiful. They tend to favour the important manuscripts. We do illuminated medieval manuscripts. We do large-scale pretty books, as it were. And sometimes the stuff that you're most interested in are not pretty. You know, most medieval manuscripts, in fact, are not pretty. And you want to be able to look at those for the same reasons that you want to study beautiful things, whereas digitization programs tend to focus on the more immediately striking. Sometimes you'll learn more about your work from your own photographs than you would from a digital one. So one respondent said that he learned something about a manuscript from his bad photos that was obscured by the institution's own professional photographs. I'd be quite interested to see what that looked like, in fact. And really the key point is that DIY photos can get you into the nitty-gritty. It's hard to specify to an institution what it is that you're interested in. You might want to look at very specific features of a manuscript, but it's hard to write that on an imaging form. If any of you have ever filled in an imaging form, they don't really allow for much discursive discussion of what it is that you're trying to do. And it can be hard to actually explain to somebody what it is that you want. And someone summed it up as the sole advantages of my pictures as they are quick and dirty and optimised for my purposes. And I think that optimised for my purposes is key. This idea that what our own research purposes are very idiosyncratic, they're not standard, and they're very personal. So DIY digital photographs enable me to take a personal record of what I'm interested in the sequence and format that's most useful for me. So it's about making the best use of your time and photographing things in the way that are most interesting to you. So you might want to look at bindings, illustrations, formats. So that method is actually very personal to the researcher. It is not something that you get from a digital collection. So what are the benefits of professional photography? Well, they're just better photographs. They are better. Better angle, better lighting, better quality. And no one was under any illusions, really, that their own photographs were as good as professional quality photographs. And I think that generally people think, you know, if you want a publication-worthy photograph, you pay for that image to be done. So there's no sense that me going in with my iPhone camera is going to put my photographer colleague out of a job. This is one of our team, and you can see the kind of equipment. You know, most DIY photographers don't have this kind of equipment. So what are the problems with DIY? What are the problems that if you're taking your own photographs? Well, sometimes it's just the lighting is bad. Sometimes the colour is not very accurate. So you have to be careful about what assumptions you make from your own photograph or someone else's photograph. You can't use, generally speaking, most libraries don't let you bring in tripods and things like that, it can be quite hard. It's not actually that easy to take decent pictures in a reading room setting. If you're trying to kind of juggle tripods and stuff, it wouldn't work. If you're trying to kind of hold it carefully and photograph it with your phone, you know, you're not going to get something top quality. And this quote, which I really like, there's almost always a bit of me in my photographs, whether that's my thumb holding pages or my legs and feet just at the bottom of the frame if it extended past the table's edge. They are fine for me because they are deeply personal and suited precisely to my purposes, but they're not really worthy of sharing. And I think that's a really nice... I like the fact that there's a bit of him in his photographs. I think that gives a sense of... Sometimes if you see someone's thumb against a book, it actually gives you a sense of the scale of the book, what it might be like to hold it. It can actually be a good thing, and it also reminds you of where you were when you took the photograph. Anyway, More generally, someone suggested that there were drawbacks, that it, and I'm not sure whether this was, if he meant messes or masses, but I quite liked messes. It can encourage researchers to amass huge messes of material rather than reading and taking notes on site. The work most likely ends up being duplicated over and over again as each researcher does the same haphazard work. It's hard to find a downside for libraries. So for this person, it's all about, you know, I'm accumulating all of this information, I don't know what to do with it. Maybe in his case or her case, this is about needing to be careful about how we organise our research material, and I think that is a skill that everybody has to do regardless of what their data might be. So to sum up the differences between institutional and DIY photography, institutional imaging is generally expensive. It can be slow if you put in a request for something to be digitised. It can be slow simply due to volume of material that's going through our imaging services. But with that cost comes good quality photographs, and that you're getting a good quality product. Openings, full page images, full volume digitization, all of that stuff is very much an institutional imaging expertise requires it. It's necessary for publication and it's standardized. It's almost always done in the same way. You know, an institution images something in the same way using the same technology. And when we talk about cost, you know, expensive stuff, as with all digital projects or digital initiatives, when we talk about cost, we're actually talking about people as well, because it's about being able to pay for the photographers that we employ. So we're not trying to make a profit out of institutional imaging, but we do have to cover the costs of the people who work on it. So institutions who, people kind of talk about, well, all this should be free, should be cheap, perhaps forgetting that you need to pay someone to do it and you need to pay them reasonably well, especially if you live in Oxford. DIY digitization is cheap, it's quick, it's poorer quality, but it's good at detail. You can focus on the details that interest you. It's good at narrative. Sometimes when we looked at Dan and Christine and I were looking at some of the photos that were uploaded, and you thought, well, I wonder what they're trying to get there. Someone was taking sort of four or five, even more, photos of the same thing, slightly different angles. I wonder what, wonder why are they doing that? And it would have made sense to them. They were trying to tell a story about something, or maybe they were picking out different pages. So the narrative that they're creating as part of their research, DIY digitization can help them support that. It's not generally suitable for publication, and the key thing is it's very idiosyncratic and it's very personal. The problems and policies around it, it's technically difficult to make your own photographs and the lighting and so on. It can be physically awkward. But there's also the question of what do you do with them? There's not many preservation options to open to you if you've taken thousands and thousands of photographs. Some people, wonderfully, are incredibly organised and they archive these very carefully themselves and they label them and so on and so forth. But there's nowhere really to put these photographs. One of the researchers that responded works on Tibetan manuscripts and he goes out in the field and he takes photographs of these. And some of the manuscripts will degrade, you know, they are made of materials that don't last very long. And eventually the physical object will no longer exist and the photographs will be the only thing that remains of them. And for him, this is a kind of endangered archives activity and he wants to be able to give these photographs to somebody. And ideally he'd give it to the Bodleian or whatever. But there's not necessarily a service or a way that we have established to take in that kind of material and to commit to supporting them. Policies vary from place to place. Some libraries are very open, and we were delighted that the Bodleian got a very good rep from the responses. And I don't think they were just being polite because it was the Bodleian that was asking them. They were fairly frank about what was good and what was bad. But the Bodleian came out as being fairly liberal in their approach to photography, and that we were helpful, which was good. But some institutions, I'm not going to name any names, were seen to be much more unhelpful, much less willing to allow you access to the manuscripts at all, never mind to photograph them. And those policies can make it difficult. And some places try to do things like effectively watermark the photograph, so you are required to put a slip of paper next to the book before you photograph it, saying where it's from. Which if you think about how hard it is to photograph anyway, if you're then trying to make sure you get the slip in, that can be quite hard. Sometimes you have to put a sheet of clear plastic over it with the institution name on it so that you have something that identifies it as that institution. And if you're taking these photographs for research and you're taking them home to look at in detail, you don't really want to have to get through the... it just makes it hard. And I don't think it actually achieves very much. I don't quite know what they are trying to do in doing that. And again, these sorts of restrictions adversely affect scholars who have fewer resources. So to loop back around to our Flickr experiment, as of yesterday, we had 42 members, 6 discussions, and 1,752 photos. But if you go on the site, you will notice that the last discussion post on it was 11 months ago. And the problem with the Flickr site is that neither I, nor Dan, nor Christine, nor Liz, our web and media manager who set up the site for us, have any time to devote to this. We can't curate the collection, we can't encourage discussion, we can't really continue in any organised way to encourage participation, so we just don't have time to make this site what it could be. We wanted to see what would happen, and what it revealed to us that even user-generated content needs curation and direction to maximise its potential. So we might be getting good, a good buzz around the fact that we're making this material open, but unless we devote some resources to it, we're not actually going to maximise its potential. And some of our respondents had caveats about whether or not Flickr was even a good place to put this kind of material. So 18 out of 21 respondents said they would use a shared site to share their images and to look at other people's images. But they were a bit dubious about Flickr. So one person said they found the deposit of all the collected images very hard to navigate, and that's true, it is hard to navigate around Flickr. And they would have preferred folders or tags. Some people were reluctant to the amount of work that would be involved in making their own file naming system remotely comprehensible to anybody else. And that it would take time to do that kind of work. Some people would only want to deposit their material if there was a kind of a momentum behind it that showed that it was going to continue and that other researchers could use it and were using it. But you don't get to that critical mass unless people deposit. So people are waiting for the critical mass to deposit. We're never going to get there. And then we have some people who responded, I'd require a minimum amount of metadata, possibly a full page view, if appropriate to the material, as well as details, such as requiring users to submit a shot of the ticket along with the item. I'd want some kind of annotation facility, allowing a conversation about the image and the ability to relate images directly to the full bibliographic record and to each other and to other resources. It's quite a lot, Ben. Yeah. that's a full-blown digital collection. Yeah. And that shows what we're up against, is that people have high expectations around accessing content online. And if we were going to do all of these things, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't, it would cost money and it would need people. So Flickr may not be suitable. So some conclusions that we can draw from this experiment and this small project. A site for user photographs shouldn't and won't replace institutional sites because they serve very different purposes. So I think some of our colleagues in special collections and in commercial aspects of the Bodleian worry about user-generated content, and you know, if we allow people to view their own photographs or other people's photographs, they won't go and buy images or use our digital collections. And I think it's quite clear from the responses that we got that this is not true. You still need to go and pay for an image to use in publication. And the people who are taking 1,000 images of your manuscripts aren't going to pay for 1,000 commercially produced images of your manuscripts, regardless of whether you allow them to photograph in the archives or not. These are different purposes, and the personal stuff will remain largely personal. And also, given how difficult it would be to actually maximise the use of these kinds of sites, it shouldn't serve as an excuse for institutions like the Bodleian not to professionally digitise things. So if we think, oh well, there's already some user has put up some really lovely photographs of a manuscript, we don't need to bother digitising this because people can already see it online. That's not really true. People want different things from different institutions, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to fall into the trap of thinking that if it's already out there, we don't have to do anything about it. User-generated content requires curation and time and money to be most useful to others. The library has dipped its toe in crowdsourcing and looking to harness the power of the crowd in one way or another. And I think it remains true that this is not a shortcut to content. It's a wonderful way of getting content from lots of different people and lots of interesting approaches, but we still have a responsibility to make something of that content to make it most useful. And a great comfort to my colleagues in the reading rooms is that researchers care just as deeply, really, about their research materials. A manuscript scholar doesn't want the manuscript that they have grown to love, hopefully, over the course of doing their research. They don't want that damaged any more than we do, and they care just as deeply about it. So they're not going to go in. By allowing people to photograph, we're really not opening it up to a kind of horde of manuscript destroying anarchists. And they also want good professional relationships with the libraries and archives that support their research. You don't actually want to go in to an archive and annoy the people who work there, because it's really not going to be to your benefit, especially if you want a nice long academic career and you're going to have to come back one day. You don't want to annoy them. So this is about professional behaviour and good quality relationships with archives, and we shouldn't be frightened about allowing people to photograph. Some more conclusions and a couple of questions. We worried a little bit, or there was a suggestion that perhaps allowing people to take photographs was a way of not engaging with the material, that it was more haphazard, that it was something that was a little, as a research practice, was something to have concerns about. But in fact, what it revealed to me, the answers that people sent back to me, was that it's a very careful and considered research practice. People are thinking very, very carefully about what they do. And it's not the case that they're being slipshod or haphazard. They're taking this stuff away so that they can spend hours and hours and hours poring over at home. This is something very careful and considered, and also that they are shaping their research around their ability to do this. And because this is a changing research practice, libraries and archives need to evolve to account for changing research practices, not just in this area, but this is what we're for. The library is effectively a service to our users, and we need to serve them in the way that best meets their needs. So if this is a change, we need to be able to cope with it and to make it as useful as possible. But I did wonder about something that's somewhat beyond the remit of our project. We're looking at this more from a service delivery and sort of how does this relate to collections delivery point of view. The research outputs themselves, what effect is it having on research? And a couple of questions that I don't think we have an answer to, but are quite interesting, I think. So we see that users' research is very positively affected by institutions where they can take photographs. If they can go in and take those photographs, they will do so. So what are the implications for the institutions that don't allow you to do so? Are their collections going to therefore be neglected? Are people going to effectively concentrate on places where they can get access and they can take that stuff away? Are they going to, you know, are we going to end up pushing more and more research into perhaps larger institutions that allow you to do this, and some of the smaller institutions will be left behind? But also, what are the overall effects on the research outputs? If you're considering more, if you're looking at collections that allow you to photograph it and you're focusing on them and you're concentrating on them, are we skewing research by allowing, you know, we're giving a lot more emphasis to those collections as opposed to those which don't allow access? And that's not a feature of the collections themselves or the content or the research that you're working on. It's just a practical thing that you're doing, and therefore should the practicality be skewing potentially the research? And finally, I'd just like to thank everybody who worked on it, Christine and Dan in particular, but also everyone who agreed to answer questions on my photographic questionnaire. To everyone who contributed to our DIY digitisation colloquium, who really amazing papers on all sorts of aspects of this question, not just the kinds of things that I've been talking about today. But also to everybody who uploaded images on our Flickr site, and I've used some of those today. So thank you to them. Thank you very much.